From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, sitting in for Terry Gross. On today's Fresh Air, we remember composer and saxophonist Steve Lacy. He died earlier this month. Lacy started his career playing a hybrid of modern jazz and Dixieland, then played with two of the greatest innovators in jazz, Cecil Taylor and Thelonious Monk. Also, why man's best friend should be treated like a dog. We hear from John Katz, author of The New Work of Dogs, which is now out in paperback. And film critic David Edelstein reviews The Terminal, the new Steven Spielberg film starring Tom Hanks. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Arabic television is reporting that Saudi security forces have killed the leader of al-Qaeda in the kingdom. Al-Arabiya TV says that Abdul Aziz al-Mukran and two other militants were killed as they disposed of the body of an American hostage they had beheaded earlier today. The report said a third militant was captured. President Bush condemned the murder of Paul Johnson, an American who worked for Lockheed Martin. NPR's Don Gagne reports from the White House.
Johnson, who'd been held hostage since June 12th, was beheaded by his captors, his death similar to that of American contractor Nicholas Berg, whose videotaped killing was posted on an al-Qaeda internet site last month. President Bush in Seattle said this latest murder shows the evil nature of the enemy.
These are barbaric people. There's no justification whatsoever for his murder. And yet they killed him in cold blood. And it should remind us that that we must pursue these people and bring them to justice before they hurt other Americans.
The president called it an attempt to intimidate America that will not work. Don Gagne, NPR News, the White House.
An American soldier was killed today in a mortar attack on a U.S. base in southern Baghdad. U.S. military officials say the attack also wounded a civilian employee who worked at a subsidiary of Halliburton Company. Earlier today, insurgents attacked a U.S. convoy, setting off a roadside bomb, then firing on the convoy from nearby rooftops. The attack left three Iraqis dead and three American soldiers wounded. The Connecticut Supreme Court has ruled that Governor John Rowland must testify in an impeachment probe. Av Harris reports from member station WNPR in Hartford.
In their 5-2 ruling, the state justices rejected the argument put forth by Rowland's legal counsel that a legislative subpoena to a sitting governor violates the separation of powers under the state and federal constitutions. Rowland has been under the threat of impeachment since January after he admitted lying about taking valuable gifts from people doing business with the state. John Wayne Fox, co-chairman of the House Impeachment Committee, says he's pleased with the High Court's decision.
The issue was critical to the authority of the House to pursue an impeachment inquiry and to attempt to get at information which is relevant and significant to the individual being investigated.
Fox says if the governor still refuses to testify, it could be grounds for an article of impeachment based on obstructing the investigation. The governor is also the subject of a federal criminal probe. For NPR News, I'm Av Harris in Hartford.
In stocks today, the Dow Jones Industrials gained 38 points to close at 10,416 in heavy trading. Advances were higher than declines by about 9 to 7. The NASDAQ gained 3 to 1986. This is NPR News. Archer Daniels Midland has agreed to pay $400 million to settle a federal antitrust lawsuit. The suit was filed by food and beverage makers such as Coca-Cola and Pepsi-Cola. It accused ADM of conspiring to fix the price of high-fructose corn syrup, a widely used sweetener. The chairman of the giant agribusiness company said ADM decided to settle rather than go to trial, where the plaintiffs were seeking damages of $1.6 billion. Singer Ray Charles was remembered today during a memorial service at the First African Methodist Episcopal Church in Los Angeles. NPR's Nova Sappho reports.
Ray Charles's funeral service was comprised almost entirely of music, as well as a touch of humor. That humor came in remembrances. B.B. King spoke of repeatedly losing to Charles at card games.
I finally got wise to that. He'd fixed the cards with his braille.
humor gave way to a touching tribute as Willie Nelson, visibly emotional, sang one of Charles's most famous songs.
Georgia. Georgia.
On its way to the burial site at the Inglewood Cemetery, the funeral procession stopped at Charles's recording studio for one last tribute, a moment of silence. Nova Safo, NPR News, Los Angeles.
The nation's trade deficit rose by 14% in the first quarter of this year. The Commerce Department says the gap between what Americans import from other countries and what U.S. firms sell overseas grew to a record $145 billion. The report said U.S. exports grew during the first 3 months of the year, but not as fast as imports. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
The NPR shop celebrates summer with books selected especially for the public radio listener. Autographed editions available in limited supply at npr.org.
This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, TV critic for the New York Daily News, sitting in for Terry Gross. Jazz musician Steve Lacy, considered by many to be the best soprano saxophone player of his era, died earlier this month. He was 69. Lacy was born in the Upper West Side of New York City as Stephen Lakritz. He studied clarinet originally, but switched to soprano saxophone after hearing Sidney Bechet on a 1941 recording of a Duke Ellington song, The Mooch. His work on soprano sax would later inspire John Coltrane to pick up the instrument. Steve Lacy apprenticed with jazz traditionalists like Pee Wee Russell and Hot Lip Page. But early in his career, he also found a home in modern jazz and the avant-garde, playing with Thelonious Monk and Cecil Taylor. He moved to Europe in the mid-60s, living mainly in Paris. 2 years ago, Lacy moved back to the U.S. and started teaching at the New England Conservatory of Music. He died in Boston of cancer. Terry spoke with Steve Lacy in 1997. Before we hear their conversation, let's listen to a 1961 recording of Thelonious Monk's Who Knows, with Steve Lacy on soprano saxophone and Don Cherry on trumpet.
You've said that certain parts of the soprano's range are inherently out of tune with the rest of the horn. What part of the range is that, and why is that so?
Well, there are notes here that are too flat and others that are too sharp. It's a little bit, maybe because it's conical rather than cylindrical. And it's sort of a bastard instrument in a way that it needs to be doctored personally. You have to really favor certain, but I mean, this is true of a lot of instruments, really. Alto also has funny regions that you have to favor, that you have to, push up, push down, and compensate for the inherent difficulties in the instrument itself.
Does this mean that you need to have a really good ear for pitch in order to play the soprano? And did you have to work hard to develop your ear?
You have to suffer, or I had to suffer really some really hard periods where it was really out of tune, where I just couldn't fix it, really. This was years and years ago in the 50s when I was struggling with the instrument. It was very difficult at that time to get it in tune. And now, after all these years, it's much easier, but I have to watch it all the time.
Now, the soprano has a naturally nasal and shrill sound in its highest notes. Is that something that you feel like you fight against or try to exploit?
It doesn't have that at all, really. It doesn't mm-hmm. need to have that at all.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's just poor playing, you know. Even John Coltrane, when he first played the instrument, he had trouble up there, and it came out nasal and all that. But after a while, it opened up. It's just like your nose, really. If you breathe through your nose, it's all about breathing, really, and it's also about conception. And when you have experience of the horn, it opens up, and it doesn't have to be nasal there at all. But that's one of the reasons I don't play the other saxophones, because I really want to just to be faithful to that one, really.
A few years ago, you did what kind of exercise book with a series of short essays? That elaborated some of your thinking about studying the instrument.
Yeah.
You have one exercise you call the No Baby exercise. Would you explain that for us?
Well, that comes from a piece that I wrote a long time ago. It was originally intended as a portrait of Sidney Bechet, who I imagined was talking to his girlfriend, and he was saying, "No, baby, no, baby, no, baby, no, baby," like that. And that's how that piece began, really. And then I wrote a melody to go with that, which was a sort of a blues in unusual harmonies. And we played that for years and years and recorded and everything. And the idea of the exercise coming from that is the dynamics, the way of saying something each time louder, and the way of corresponding your saxophone to your own speech.
So, in other words, learning the things we already intuitively
language.
Know about speech
about
and
language.
Applying that to the instrument.
It's about language. My fundamental thing is about language, really. I deal with language. Mm-hmm. The jazz is language. The saxophone is language. And a lot of the music I write is based on literature and texts and language.
You recommend trying to sing and play whatever you hear.
Yeah.
Do you sing a lot as part of your exercise?
Well, yeah, that's very important. The connection with the voice, the ear, and the saxophone is fundamental, is something I learned in Japan, actually, from a Zen master, a flute player, who gave me a couple of lessons, and that was the first lesson he gave me, was the connection with the ear, the voice, and the instrument, and the breath. And that was a huge revelation for me.
What was the connection that he made clear that you hadn't thought of before?
That my own voice was my own ear, was my own breath, was my own sound, that it was all one. That in the conception that it is, it's just one thing. It's got to be like one thing.
What was your role in inspiring John Coltrane to try soprano saxophone?
Well, I was sort of the model. In other words, he heard me play it, and he thought it was like he was shopping, and I was modeling. So he heard me with, I was playing with Jimmy Giuffre at the Five Spot, and he came in and he heard me play, and he was intrigued by the instrument, and he asked me what key it was in, and when I told him it was B-flat, he said, "Oh, yeah?" And then a couple of weeks later, Don Cherry called me from Chicago, and he said, "Listen to this," and he held the telephone up, and I could hear Train playing the soprano.
What did you think of what you first heard of his?
Well, I had a laugh, really. But, I thought, wow, it's nice to have some company.
You're not saying what you thought of the playing.
No, I mean, it sounded intriguing to me. I liked it, really. It sounded good. I mean, you know, if Don Cherry calls you up and said, "Listen to this," it's probably going to be good.
Steve Lacy, who else was playing soprano when you started to play in the 50s?
Nobody, really. It was in complete disuse. It had gone out of a phase. Like the musicians had considered it. You know, people played it in the 20s and the 30s, and it went by the 40s. I mean, even Johnny Hodges stopped in 1942, and it from that point on, it disappeared because it had a reputation for being out of tune, and arrangers didn't know what to do with it, and it just fell into disuse. So I think the only person that I knew of playing it was a student of Bechet's, who was Bob Wilbur, and he was playing exactly like Bechet, really, and that's all.
And
nobody else was playing it.
What were the pros and cons of feeling like you had the field to yourself?
Well, the advantages were many. I didn't compete with anybody. I didn't threaten anybody else's job, so that I was welcomed into all these traditional bands that I played with. My teacher, Cecil Scott, took me around and had me sit in with the likes of Red Allen, Pee Wee Russell, and all these people. And after a while, I started getting hired and working with all these original masters who were at the peak of their form, really. They were in their 50s and 60s. I was 19, 20. And that's how I cut my teeth, really. I learned from playing with these people. And it was the New Orleans School and the Chicago School and the Kansas City School.
And the disadvantages?
And the disadvantages were nobody hired me after a while.
Because they didn't know what to do with you?
The traditional, yeah, I stopped playing the clarinet. See, I was working with Max Kaminsky regularly, and I was playing soprano and clarinet, and it was working very well. And I decided to concentrate only on the soprano at that point because I think I was starting to play with Cecil Taylor also. And when I told Max I'm not going to play the clarinet anymore, he said, "You're crazy. You won't get any work at all." And it was true. Those people, I stopped working with them, and I started to play with Cecil Taylor.
Let me play something that was part of your recording debut. This was made, I think it was 1954. When you were, I believe, 20 years old, in a kind of traditional jazz group led by Dick Sutton,
mm-hmm.
and you played both clarinet and soprano in this. We'll hear you on soprano on a recording of Liza. You want to say anything about this session before we hear it?
Well, that was a young band. They called it Progressive Dixieland. It was Dick Sutton's conception. And it was influenced by Mulligan and by Bix Beiderbecke. It was and Miles, and it was like a hybrid movement. It had some freshness to it. It was good.
An interesting concept and interesting music as well. So this is Liza with my guest Steve Lacy on soprano saxophone, recorded in 1954, his recording debut.
Soprano saxophonist Steve Lacy on a 1954 recording of Liza. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. ¶¶ back with more of soprano saxophonist and composer Steve Lacy. A couple of years after playing modern Dixieland in the mid-50s, Steve Lacy joined a group led by avant-gardist Cecil Taylor. Terry Gross asked Lacy about that shift in his direction.
Well, yeah, it was a radical change, that's for sure. But Cecil had very strong traditional roots also, and we both had a shared interest in the Ellington line, and that's like a line that covers a lot of ground, really, and goes through... See, I was playing with Don Fry at Jimmy Ryan's when I met Cecil, and that was like the Ellington, James P. Johnson line, all that. That's traditional. And Cecil also comes from, like, Duke Ellington and Thelonious Monk and Bud Powell. And this is another tradition, but in a way they're the same. It's the same story. It's just one ocean of jazz, really, with a lot of different strains to it.
Cecil Taylor took you to hear Thelonious Monk. And that, I think, really changed your music, too. When you heard Monk and became very excited by his harmonies and his rhythms, his odd rhythms, I'm wondering how you translated some of that to soprano. For example, a lot of Monk's music is based on these really unusual, interesting harmonies, very often dissonant harmonies, and you're playing a single line instrument.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you can't make chords on a soprano saxophone. So how did you... Is there a way you feel you were able to apply some of his harmonic thinking into your horn?
Well, first of all, I play the piano as a laboratory, and I learned all his tunes at the piano, really, with the, you know, with the chords and everything, with the sounds, with the intervals and the voicings as much as I could. And then working on my horn, you can't play a chord all at once, but you can delineate it. You can outline it. You can express it. There is a way to express everything on everything if you can find it. It's a question of imagination.
Monk invited you to join his quartet, making the group a quintet for the 4 months that you were there. Do you have any idea why he asked you to join? I mean, obviously he liked what you were doing.
He was familiar with me. He knew me and all that, and he knew I was really not an expert, but an aficionado of his music. And maybe he thought I needed the experience. That's what I like to think. I like to think that he gave me that opportunity to really see what was happening from the inside.
You've been recording Monk compositions throughout your career, and I want to play one of the duets from a recent album called Five Facings, and it's a series of duets with five different other jazz musicians. And I want to play one of the duets that you recorded with Misha Mengelberg, a Dutch pianist who's also very influenced by Monk. Let's hear your recording of Monk's Off Minor, a duet with the Dutch pianist Misha Mengelberg. And... this was recorded in 1996. It seems to me on this, it's as if you on the soprano saxophone are playing the right hand and Misha Mengelberg on piano is playing the left hand.
Well, that's, in a way, I mean, I am a melodic instrument. All I can do is a single line of melody. And Misha has all the harmonic equipment down there, the armaments. He's armed to the teeth, really. He could do all that stuff, but... he's got the taste and the discretion and the knowledge of Monk to complement what I do. And we always hit it off well together.
Okay, well, this is Off Minor.
Thank you.
And what did you learn seeing the music from the inside? What are some things you got from actually playing with Monk and talking with him?
I learned to stick to the point and to not lose the point and not get carried away, and to play with the other musicians and not to get all wrapped up in my own thing, and not to just play interesting notes just to be interesting, you know, or weird notes just to be weird. He mostly told me what not to do. He never told me what to do, but he told me what not to do when I did something that bothered him. For example, when I played, when we were playing together, sometimes he would play something on the piano, and I would pick that up and play that on my horn. I thought I was being slick, you know, and he stopped me. He said, "Don't do that. That's, you know, I'm the piano player. You play your part. I'm accompanying you. Don't pick up on my things." You know, he got me out of the thing of trying to be too hip. I was trying to be too hip, and it wasn't swinging sometimes, you know. Then he told me, make the drummer sound good, because I was playing some things that confused the drummer, because I was confused myself. And so the drummer was not swinging, you know, and Monk told me, no, make the drummer sound good. And that was an enormous help to me, really. It stopped me cold, really, and changed my focus. And Monk's thing, he told me, let things go by. Let certain things go by. Don't play everything. Just play certain things. Let other things go by. It's what you don't play that's very important, really, and that's extremely important.
A kind of intervals of laying out of the
space.
Yeah.
Space, using the space as time,
mm-hmm.
and using time and digging time as space.
Steve Lacy, speaking to Terry Gross in 1997. He died earlier this month at age 69. I'm David Bianculli, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by Endless Pools, a treadmill for swimmers, allowing people to swim at home year-round, indoors or outside. DVD or video available at 877-ENDLESS. That's 877-ENDLESS or endlesspool.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, are we asking too much of our pets? Are dogs taking the emotional place of friends or family? We talk with journalist and dog trainer John Katz. In his latest book, The New Work of Dogs, he explores the relationship between people and their dogs. Also, David Edelstein reviews the new Steven Spielberg film, The Terminal. This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, in for Terry Gross. Despite his name, John Katz is a dog person, and he's concerned about the roles pets play in our lives. Do we ask too much of our pets? Do we rely on them for the company and emotional support we're not getting from friends and family? Do we ask things of them that go against their nature? Katz discusses these questions in his latest book, The New Work of Dogs, now out in paperback. His previous book, A Dog Year, was about the death of his two Labrador retrievers and how he raised and trained two border collies. Katz also is a member of the Association of Pet Dog Trainers. But yes, he does have a life apart from his dogs. He is the author of 12 books, including a series of suburban detective novels. He's written for The New York Times, The Wall Street Journal, and Wired, and he's a contributing editor to the public radio program Marketplace. Terry spoke to Katz last year. He was at a studio in New Jersey with his two border collies sleeping at his feet. Terry asked him about the new ways dogs figure into the lives of humans.
In the last 25 or 30 years, I really date this to the rise of television and the decline in the extended family and the rise in divorce rates and more people living alone and work becoming unstable for many people. People have begun to use dogs in a more intensely personal way as either human surrogates, substitutes for people in cases where they're lonely or disconnected or fragmented, or as members of the family. Dogs are getting human names, they're sleeping in bed. I kind of joke sometimes that, you know, the boomers created the gifted and talented child, and now they're working on the gifted and talented dog. where, you know, one woman came to me at a reading and said, well, you know, Mondays we do agility and Tuesdays we do obedience and Wednesday we go herding, and what can I do on Thursdays and Fridays? I said, well, maybe the guy should just, you know, sit in the yard and, you know, sniff some other dog's butt or something, you know, let him relax. On the other hand, I found the subject to be a little darker and more complicated than I thought when I entered it. I think the culture kind of glorifies the human-dog bond for good reason. It's quite wonderful. But sometimes it's a bit unthinking and uncritical to the extent that there aren't a lot of people really wondering whether this view of dogs as human-like is really good for them, or whether, I guess I ended up wondering myself whether it's really good for people.
So you're seeing this like new relationship between people and their dogs as being troubling because what it says about people's people-to-people relationships. Are you watching dogs become more neurotic as people are relying them on them more for love and companionship and telepathy and mysticism and all these other things?
Yes, I think there's enormous evidence, and I think any trainer would agree with me. For one thing, last year in the United States, 400,000 children were bitten severely enough to require hospitalization, which is a staggering rise. You see dogs are increasingly under pressure, neurotic, chewing up the house, jumping on people. You have the new element of the rescue dog, the abused dog, which dog that certainly exists. But this all becomes an element in our ability to do what I think is our primary responsibility with animals, which is to show them how to live in the world, which means training them, which means thinking about how we get them, thinking about the kind of dog or cat that we get, whether it's right for us, and then doing the work to help it acclimate to an increasingly hostile world. So I do see behavior that's very, very increasingly neurotic, and as the dogs are being pressured to do things dogs really can't do.
Like what? What are some of the things dogs are being pressured to do?
Well, people perceive dogs as loving them unconditionally and uncritically, and to some extent that's certainly true, but dogs really can't understand when we're depressed or when we had a bad day at work, or they really can't give us the kind of emotional support that human beings can give us.
They can't say to you, your boss was wrong, you're right.
Well, I had a great, you know, my first shocking introduction to this actually was when I took my border collie, Orson, who had a lot of problems, out to a trainer in Pennsylvania named Carolyn Wilkie. And I said, you know, Carolyn, I said, I'm having terrible trouble with this dog. You know, the problem is he's so attached to me. I think if anything happened to me, well, you just have to shoot him because he couldn't live with anybody else. And I remember her her getting right in my face and saying, listen, pal, if anything happened to you, I would buy a can of beef liver. And in 2 days, this dog would forget that you ever walked the earth. And don't you forget it. And this was a bit of a shock to me, but it was something I really needed to hear because I could see the truth of it. It doesn't mean that that he doesn't love me or that I don't love him, but it means it was a reminder to me that I was beginning to project onto him things that were mine, an attitude about authority. I saw him as being rebellious and devious and willful, and these were things that were much more true of me than him. The problem was I just didn't know how to train him.
Breeds often have special, you know, different breeds of dogs often have special skills, a special type of intelligence, and special needs. You have border collies that you've gotten from breeders.
Right.
What are the unique qualities of border collies?
Well, these dogs have to have work to do, or they go nuts. You know, they're very intense. They're very energetic. So we do all kinds of work. We clear geese out of neighborhood parks and schoolyards. We go do sheep herding 3 or 4 times a week. We go for lots of walks a day. You know, but they have. This is a good example of a breed. They're great dogs, but if you don't have work for them to do, they're not good dogs to have. And you see them all over the place in cities now, ever since the movie Babe came out. And it's a good example. I mean, it's the same with dogs like Labs and Retrievers. They're wonderful dogs, but they need to have work. They need to have exercise. A lot of breeds have very distinct characteristics. Springer Spaniels, for example, have a reason why they're called Springers. And there's a number of breeds, you know, Bichons and Westies and other dogs that really like to be in apartments and don't need a lot of exercise and don't mind being left alone. You know, there are very good breeds for people in almost every circumstance if you do the work. They're dogs that are fine in apartments, dogs that don't mind being left alone for hours if they get some exercise. But the marketing of dogs in America, the emotionalization of them sort of is leading people to, you know, it's like the bigger and more energetic the dog in the suburbs, the more likely people are to get it. So you see Labs and Retrievers all over the place, these big 100-pound dogs with no chance to run anywhere. No exercise, and who are not trained.
Well, you know, you said that you got your border collies and that they need to work, and you take them to sheep herd a few times a week. Do you have a lot of farms within your area that have sheep?
There actually are more than you might think. I actually go to Pennsylvania, which is only an hour from me, and we actually take care of a couple of hundred sheep. We graze them several times, 3 or 4 times a week, and I have come to love that quite a bit. I'm probably the least likely person on the planet to be doing that. But I've really come to love doing that with the dogs. You don't have to go, there's other kinds of work you can do from agility work to just going to parks and throwing balls and frisbees around. But it's been quite extraordinary for me to be involved with the dogs and with sheep because you sort of see why there are dogs when you do something like that. And the dog people are quite wonderful. You know, the dog lovers will do almost anything for their dogs. Once they figure out what it is they ought to be doing.
John Katz, speaking with Terry Gross last year. His latest book, The New Work of Dogs, is now out in paperback. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to Terry's 2003 interview with John Katz.
How did you get your border collies?
A breeder in Texas read Running to the Mountain, which was not about dogs, but had two dogs in it, two labs, my previous dogs.
This is about a 6-month break you took from your real life to live alone on a mountain with your dogs.
Right, that's basically right. Somewhat a book about Thomas Merton and some of his writings about solitude, experience with solitude, I guess, and was part of the book. And I went with two labs, without whom I don't think I could have survived, the experience. They kept me company, and they were quite great. One of the dogs, whenever he wanted to play, he would come up and nip me on the butt and get me moving. And I recounted this in the book. And this breeder, Deanna, in Texas, read it, and she said, "Now that's a person that could have a border collie." And she had this very troubled dog. At the time, his name was Devin, who was a sort of failed obedience dog and had been confined for several months in a crate, and it was just a mess. And she shipped him to Newark and said, "You know, I have this feeling from reading your work that you will keep faith with this dog, that you'll do whatever it takes to work things out with this dog." And he was a nightmare. He was practically destroyed my neighborhood, my house, dented my marriage pretty good. Was jumping through windows, hurting school buses. He was just out of his mind. And that's what began this whole journey of sort of understanding. And I loved him right away, of course, and identified with him. And in order to keep him, I knew I was going to have to learn a lot more about dogs than I knew. And that's what started the whole turn towards dog riding. And the fact that he can lie here like this is a miracle, really.
So you had this that ornery dog that wasn't behaving, and you had to train him in order to be able to live with the dog and have the dog live in your community, and in order to remain married.
That's right. Right. So, in order to not have windows and all that sort of thing.
I mean, there's a difference, I think, between training a puppy where all the puppy's behaviors are just kind of like puppy behaviors, but they haven't really learned a lot yet. You don't have to unteach them a lot of things. Compared to an adult dog that's had something of a life, and you have to totally refashion their behavior, where did you start?
This was one of the most difficult things I'd ever done in my life. It's still ongoing. I think it will never be quite finished, but I don't think I've ever taken on a harder thing for me because it spoke directly to my own problems as a human. Impatience and anger and frustration and short attention span and distraction and all the things that get in the way of doing what he needed. And I loved him, of course, right away and was confronted with this very simple drama. Either I learned about dogs, and I was surprised, by the way, how little I knew about dogs. I thought I knew more than I did. When I started hanging around with trainers, I did take a training course and became a trainer to research the new work of dogs. I don't train dogs, but I learned enough about it so that I could know a little bit of what I was writing about. I was stunned that I was almost everything I thought about dogs was wrong. Everything I thought was going on in his head was wrong. The way I was communicating with him was wrong. My tone of voice was wrong. The repetition of commands was wrong. My whole understanding of what he was about was wrong. And when I realized how essentially simple, how food-driven, how attention-driven he was, it became, I wouldn't say easy, very, very manageable to do. But in order to do that, I had to acknowledge, you know, repeatedly that almost every assumption I had about dogs was not right.
What's one or two of the things that you were doing wrong?
Well, the first thing, is the most common. I was anthropomorphizing him. I was attributing all sorts of human-like emotions to him. I was, you know, he was being devious. He was being rebellious. He was being willful. He was being stubborn. He was jealous. He was all these things that humans are that are not really dog traits. What he really was confused. You know, he couldn't tell friend from foe. He didn't understand what people were asking. I mean, he didn't make sense of the world. This is, by the way, why I started with the sheep. I mean, I'm not a person who's naturally inclined to spend time with sheep, but it's just not in my repertoire. But everything I read about border collies, including this trainer in Ireland who I was emailing with, said, look, this dog will not make sense of the world until he does what he's supposed to do and gets around some livestock for a while. And that was true. I mean, he's not much of a sheepdog. He's much too skitsy and intense for that. But the world is beginning to make sense to him, and that was very good advice. But I think this whole idea, the less I saw him as a human version of me, and the more I saw him as a dog, the easier it was to train him, the better behaved he became, and the happier he and I are, and the more likely I was to remain married.
Did you do the whole reward and punishment approach?
I came into the hands of a positive reinforcement trainer who does not do punishment. She does, and this is Carolyn, she's very tough about that. You basically give the dog the chance to succeed and praise it with a combination of food and verbal and physical reward. And you don't yell at it or scold it or correct it or throw things at it or put electronic devices on it. You just praise them when they're doing the right thing.
Why no punishment?
Well, the positive reinforcement, which is a growing training in the dog world, really holds it that yelling and throwing things and criticism makes them more stressed and that they end up having displaced aggression and displaced neurotic behavior, that they don't, any more than kids, they don't like being yelled at. And they don't like having things thrown at them. And they don't like having people scream in their faces. And that, you know, like a kid, you can get a dog to do anything by scaring it. But as also with a kid, that's not the best way to do it. I'm embarrassed to tell you that a new dog arrived in my household last week, a puppy from Colorado named Rose. And I'm training her in this positive way from the beginning. And it's amazing to me, in 24 hours, this dog comes and sits happily and lies down and is housebroken. I'm a great believer in that. Now, I'm not a I'm not 100% positive person, you know, so I sometimes will lose it, as we all will, which is fine. But I think it's a great training method. I think it really works. I think the dog responds very quickly. And best of all, you have this great grounded relationship with a dog that's born out of real positive affection and not out of terror or intimidation, which I think is great.
Okay, housebreaking a dog. I mean, when I was growing up, I didn't have a dog, sadly. But the people who I saw training their dogs, what they would do is if the dog, like, pooped in the house, they would bring the dog over to the poop, basically stick the dog's nose in it, spank him a little bit, and then put them either on the newspaper or outside, wherever it was that they wanted to direct the dog to be pooping in the future. That's negative reinforcement, right?
Yeah, that's a great. I did that with my labs. I mean, I did that with many dogs. The way I housebroke Rose or Homer in a day or two was I got a crate. I put the puppy in the crate, fed the dog in the crate, waited 30 minutes, carried the dog outside. The dog immediately went to the bathroom. I danced around in the moonlight, yelling and whooping and throwing food around. And three times, and the dog was housebroken. I didn't drag her. I didn't stick her nose in it. I didn't scream at her. I didn't do any bad dog. And it worked in 24 hours. I've done that with two dogs now.
You put them, you feed them in a box, and then 30 minutes later...
You just feed them in the crate. You get a kennel crate, and they like it. It makes them feel safe.
Uh-huh.
You give them their food in the crate. You just put the bowl in the crate. You close the crate. You go... You know, read the paper, watch television, and in half an hour or so, you come back, you open the crate, you pick the dog out, take the dog outside. The dog will almost immediately go to the bathroom because puppies go quickly after they eat. And then you just praise the dog. You make a lot of noise. You give it a treat. You tell how good they are. You get excited and dance around and look like a jerk. And it's, I mean, I've twice now, I've housebroken dogs in about a day. You'll have occasional accidents or something, but they're happy. You know, this is an interesting thing to talk about, Terry, because it goes to the heart of why I wrote the book. It's a good example of why the more you understand what dogs are like and treat them as dogs, the easier it is to do these things. Housebreaking is really very simple. Dogs prefer to go outside, and they don't like to be yelled at. It just makes them more nervous and more likely to pee all over the place. So this is such a simple thing. I mean, the way I learned to teach my dogs to come to me before, I used to yell and scream and throw chains and jump around and make a lot of noise to no effect. Now I just get, I put a bunch of meatballs in my hand and I walk backwards. There's not a dog on the planet that won't come running towards you. And when they come to me, I give her the meatball and say, good girl, good come. And she knows how to come. And I didn't, you know, there's no yelling or throwing or stomping or you know, or shock collars or any of this dreadful stuff. I sometimes think when I spent this year with people and their dogs that what I saw was a country, as much as we love our dogs, we're almost having a civil war with them. Because we all know people like this who, I'm sorry my dog jumped on you, but he was abused, so I can't train him. Or she's always been aggressive with people. Or she's always hated female dogs. Or she's always chewed up the house. People live with these awful behaviors and are constantly yelling and tugging at their dogs and scolding them and clucking about them. And it's too bad because it doesn't need to be like that, really. And it was frustrating, really, to see.
Well, John Katz, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you. I appreciate it, Terry.
John Katz, speaking with Terry Gross last fall. His latest book, The New Work of Dogs, is now out in paperback. Coming up, film critic David Edelstein reviews the new Steven Spielberg movie, The Terminal. This is Fresh Air.
Thank you.
Tom Hanks played a lovable simpleton in Forrest Gump and an executive marooned on an island in Castaway. In The Terminal, he plays a lovable simpleton marooned in a New York airport. The film is his third collaboration with director Steven Spielberg and also stars Catherine Zeta-Jones and Stanley Tucci. Film critic David Edelstein has a review.
In 2002, with the 1-2 punch of Minority Report and Catch Me If You Can, Steven Spielberg seemed to purge all the mawkish and synthetic strokes from his filmmaking. Catch Me was a special treat. It was larky and sad in the same breath, and it hummed along with a finger-popping mid-60s cool that was candy for the eye and the ear. It had wonderful scenes in airports, and the prospect of Spielberg making a whole movie in a terminal, exploring it top to bottom as a kind of ecosystem through the eyes of a non-English speaker who's marooned. What a big, fat, juicy premise. And what a big, fat letdown The Terminal is. Not a disaster, no, but a good movie that congeals into something icky and fake before your eyes. Tom Hanks is Viktor Nevorsky from the fictional Eastern European country of Krakosia. He looks heavy and pasty in his ill-fitting suit, and he hands his passport to the customs officer like a guy who made his peace long ago, giving papers to men in uniforms. He doesn't even seem put out when he's taken to see the airport security official, Frank Dixon, played by Stanley Tucci, and his uniformed aide, played by Barry Shabaka Henley.
I have a bit of bad news. It seems that your country has suspended all traveling privileges on passports that have been issued by your government, and our State Department has revoked the visa that was going to allow you to enter the United States. That's it in a nutshell, basically, right? Anyway, it seems that while you were in the air, there was a military coup in your country. Now, most of the dead were members of the Presidential Guard. They were attacked in the middle of the night. It was a terrible firefight. They got it all on GHN, I think. Anyway, there were very few civilian casualties, so I'm sure your family's fine.
Mr. Nevorsky, your country was annexed from the inside. The Republic of Krakosia is under new leadership.
Krakosia!
Dixon ends that scene by informing Viktor, who of course doesn't understand a word except Krakosia, that he has fallen into a void. He can't fly back, and he can't enter the U.S. He is, quote, unacceptable. The airport, it's obviously JFK, will be Victor's home. It sounds implausible, but there was an Iranian stranded in France's Charles de Gaulle under similar circumstances. He's still there, in fact, and has possibly lost his mind. And there's an irresistible movie theme here. Adaptation. A hero who's hopelessly out of his element, yet through doggedness and smarts and a primal survival instinct, becomes a master of a new environment. We're more used to adaptation stories in the Robinson Crusoe mode. And Hanks did one of those, too, in Castaway. Here, his island cave is a gate that's under construction. He breaks up some seats for a bed. He cuts the fuse on those awful fluorescents and the muzak. The song is Stranger in Paradise. He figures out that returning luggage carts to their racks will generate quarters, which he uses to buy fast food. He picks up some English. He gets to know the employees. He learns how things work at a capitalist airport. So far, so intriguing. Hanks does good, subtle physical comedy, and Spielberg treats the airport as a multi-leveled toy store teeming with exotic people. And there are fun scenes with Viktor playing hide-and-seek with security cameras. But the film begins to edge into a very tiresome brand of melodrama. First, Tucci's Dixon becomes a villain, not just callously indifferent to Victor's plight, but actively malevolent, driven mad to know what the Krakosian carries in a rusty peanut can. And then Viktor turns into a populist folk hero among the immigrants, minorities, and minimum wagers. Now he facilitates the romance of a food service worker and a customs agent. Now he rescues a Russian, trying to carry medicine from Canada to his sick father. Now he makes peace with a misanthropic janitor, played by Kumar Palana from the Royal Tenenbaums. Now he woos the unlucky in love flight attendant, played by Catherine Zeta-Jones. This saintly chaplain-esque innocent warms the hearts of everyone but that meanie Stanley Tucci. And what's in that can? It had me rolling my eyes. Spielberg has learned to soft-pedal the schlock, and not every subplot ends picture-perfectly, but most of the payoffs are cheap. And for all the lip service it gives to Homeland Security, The Terminal misses the chance to explore the divided feelings that airports and air travel and the arrival of foreigners have on us post-9/11. in which everything romantic and open-ended has become permeated with dread. The world explodes, but delusional Hollywood sentimentality, that's a comforting constant.
David Edelstein is film critic for Slate. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Julian Hirschfeld. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Sharrock directs the show. WHYY's executive producer of national radio programming is Elizabeth Perez Luna. Our theme music was composed by Joel Forrester and performed by the Microscopic Septet. For Terry Gross, I'm David Bean Cooley.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations, by Barnes & Noble, publishers of Portable Professor, a new series of university-quality courses on compact disc, available at Barnes & Noble stores and online at bn.com. From the Sundance Channel, presenting Trembling Before God, exploring homosexuality and the Jewish faith, part of the Out Loud Film Fest on Sundance Channel, tonight at 10. And by Endless Pools, a treadmill for swimmers, allowing people to swim at home year-round, indoors or outside. DVD or video available at 877-ENDLESS. That's 877-ENDLESS or endlesspool.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
If I were a rich man.
On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Sheldon Harnick and Jerry Bach about the new Broadway production of Fiddler on the Roof. It stars Alfred Molina as Tevye. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
If I were a bitty, bitty rich, digga, digga, deedle, didle man, I...